From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson at NPR West in Culver City, California today.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump is making his first official visit to Wisconsin since winning the White House. And until last year, Wisconsin hadn't voted for a Republican president since 1984. Trump will tour the Snap-on Tools plant in Kenosha, in a county that he won by fewer than 300 votes. And he'll sign executive orders aimed at strengthening Buy American laws and Hire American rules, specifically the H-1B. Visa program, which allows U.S. firms to hire skilled workers from overseas. Joining us with more is NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Hi there, Scott.
Hi.
So the president won Wisconsin very narrowly. What's he trying to convey by going to a manufacturer there?
Well, you're right. This is a swing state. He carried it by less than 23,000 votes. Wisconsin is also the second most manufacturing-intensive state in the whole country, behind only Indiana. About one out of six workers in Wisconsin is in manufacturing. That's compared to about one out of 11 nationwide. So this is an area and an audience that's very receptive to the president's message that policy should put a premium on promoting American factories.
Okay, so regarding that executive order and the Buy American part, I mean, he can't really make an executive order to tell consumers what to do, but he can about the federal government, right?
That's right. And in fact, there are already existing laws that say that the federal government should buy American-made products when spending taxpayer dollars. Some of those laws have been on the books for decades. But administration officials feel like that's been watered down over the years, that the government often sidesteps those rules with waivers. There are also trade agreements that the United States has with dozens of other countries where products made in those other countries are treated just the same as American products for purposes of the Buy American standard. The White House, of course, has been critical of a lot of those trade agreements in lots of ways. Mm-hmm. They're not going so far as to say, let's get rid of those trade agreements, but they do want to do an assessment of how that affects the Buy American provisions.
Now, on the Hire American part then, on the H-1B visa program, what changes would the president like to make there?
Well, this is a program. Right now, the U.S. government gives out about 85,000 visas, H-1Bs, a year. And the program was initially designed to help especially technology companies hire foreigners for jobs that required special skills and special training for which American workers were not available. Critics say that the program has been abused in such a way that a lot of times employers will use these H-1Bs simply to undercut American workers and hire, sort of temporary workers from overseas at a lower wage. What the administration wants to do is direct all the departments that have some oversight of this to conduct a review of how they might crack down on that. And they also want to change the way those 85,000 visas are distributed. So instead of a random lottery, which is what's used now, they would put a priority on jobs that pay the most and really require the most skills, trying to kind of get back to what the H-1Bs were supposed to be targeted for.
Yeah. In the last couple seconds we have, Scott, how binding are these executive orders? Does he need congressional approval for any of this?
Well, on the H-1Bs in particular, there are certainly things that the administration can do around the edges that would modify the program. But any real sweeping change would take an act of Congress. And that might be rolled in with a broader look at guest worker programs generally, maybe including the H-2B visas that President Trump himself has used to hire seasonal workers at his properties in places like Mar-a-Lago.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley, thank you so much, Scott.
Always good to be with you.
Well, today, Turkey's president called on opposition parties to respect the results of this week's referendum, which grant the president sweeping new powers. The referendum won by a narrow margin, 51-49%, and opposition groups are calling for a recount. President Trump called Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan yesterday to congratulate him, but many experts worry that the country is sliding from democracy into authoritarian rule. Joining us now is one of those people, Stephen Cook. He's a senior fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and an expert on Turkish politics. Stephen, welcome.
Pleasure to join you.
And were you surprised by this close referendum result?
I'm not totally surprised. Turkey is a country that is polarized. President Erdogan only won about 52% of the vote in his 2014 presidential election. But of course, the playing field in the run-up to the referendum was hardly level. The ruling Justice and Development Party dominated the airwaves. Opponents of Yes were harassed and intimidated. And it seems that given all of that, the 51% is an underperformance for President Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party.
Do you think the results themselves are legit, though?
Well, there is enough evidence already of questionable electoral activity on the part of the Justice and Development Party and their supporters to warrant the opposition to demand a recount, to seek redress in the Turkish Constitutional Court, although they'll have no standing there, and then ultimately perhaps take it to the European Court of Human Rights. All that being said, it's very unlikely that the results will be reversed.
What do you think of President Trump calling Erdogan and congratulating him on this victory?
Well, it certainly puts the United States in some interesting company, along with the leadership of Hamas, the Palestinian terrorist organization, the Palestinian Authority, the leaders of Djibouti and Turkmenistan. Even Vladimir Putin had not called President Erdogan by the time that President Trump placed his telephone call. My sense is, though, that there is a lot of tension in the U.S.-Turkish relationship over the fight against ISIS in Syria, where the United States has aligned itself with Syrian Kurdish groups that the Turks regard as terrorists, and that President Trump, in his call to President Erdogan, may have been seeking to mitigate those tensions as operations against the Islamic State ramp up, and of course, as the U.S. military continues to work with the dominant Syrian Kurdish fighting force called the People's Protection Units, which the Turks, as I said, consider to be a terrorist organization that is a threat to Turkey's security and stability.
The U.S. has a lot of interests in Turkey. It's a very important country strategically. It's close to a lot of countries that we're involved with right now in varying ways. And it's a Muslim democracy, or at least it's a democracy right now. And you write in Foreign Policy, "Rip Turkey, 1921 to 2017, that Erdogan's win closes a chapter of Turkey's modern history." Let's first talk about what modern Turkey was post-Ataturk. What do you feel is going to go away?
Well, the point of the article was to suggest that way back in 1921, when the Turkish parliament, the new nationalist parliament of Turkey, issued the Law and Fundamental Organization, they were setting out the principles of what we think of as a modern state, as a modern polity. This was a dramatic break from the Ottoman Empire and the Sultan, who wielded unquestioning power, was vested both with political and religious legitimacy. And the Turkish state, as we know it, has never been truly a democracy. At best, it was an imperfect democracy, but there was always that aspiration that successive Turkish constitutions laid out principles and ideals that were democratic, and Turks have over time internalized democratic practices. So there was always that hope that this imperfect republic that could be repressive and at times violent would evolve into a democracy. And that there was great hope for that when the Justice and Development Party actually came to power and began undertaking reforms that aligned with European Union norms and principles. However, what President Erdogan and his Justice and Development Party have done through this referendum is basically undermine those organizational principles going back to 1921 and have undermined the checks and balances in Turkey's political system and given President Erdogan sweeping powers, powers that are reminiscent to the kinds of powers that the Ottoman sultans had.
I have one more thing I want to ask you about. With all of this and what we're hearing about Erdogan and Turkey moving towards authoritarianism, we can't forget the fact that Turkey has taken in so many of the refugees that Europe wouldn't accept from Syria and other places. What does that say to you?
Oh, well, you know, this is one of the things that is hidden behind all of the criticism of Turkey's deepening authoritarianism, the acceleration of the purge that has been going on since at least the failed coup last July, is that the Turks have opened their borders to 3 million refugees, most of them from Syria, and have upheld international standards in trying to care for these people. The Turks deserve a lot of credit for that. And Turkey has positioned itself in its region and beyond as a leader of the Muslim world and has demonstrated this caring for, this solidarity with fellow Muslims. When no one else was in Somalia, for example, Turkish aid and relief workers were there in the name of Muslim solidarity. So there are bright spots to the long rule of the Justice and Development Party. It's not all bad.
That's Stephen Cook, who is a senior fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen, thank you.
My pleasure.
The country feels intensely politically polarized right now for many reasons. One of those reasons, each side believes the other is wrong and that their own side knows better. But Brown University cognitive scientist Stephen Sloman says the truth is, basically all humans are ignorant. It's our natural state, he says. But that isn't a terrible thing because we're terrific at creating communities of knowledge. But how do we stop those communities from battling each other in a way that's detrimental to us all? Well, Sloman delves into all of this in his recent book, The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. I recently talked to him and we began by asking him why he says we're all ignorant.
Well, I say it in part because there's a lot of work showing that people can't answer a lot of basic questions. You know that 25% of Americans don't know whether the Earth revolves around the sun or the sun revolves around the Earth.
You know, 2017?
Well, this study was done a few years ago.
Okay,
but you
in
know
the
what?
Modern just, age, yeah.
In the modern age, that's right. And it's not just true of Americans. It's true of people all around the world.
Wow. Okay. Oh, so, but you say it's more fundamental than that. I mean, you, as I mentioned, you write that ignorance is our natural state, and that exists for a reason. And why?
Yeah. So the real claim isn't that people are stupid. I mean, people are relatively ignorant, but the real idea is that people think they understand things better than they do. And this has been demonstrated in the psychological laboratory by a great psychologist at Yale named Frank Kyle and his students who showed that if you ask people to explain simple objects like how toilets work or how even ballpoint pens work, they find themselves unable to do so. And in fact, what asking them to explain does is it bursts their bubble of understanding so that they rate their understanding as lower than they thought it was. So people admit they lived in an illusion of knowledge by virtue of trying to explain how things work and failing.
Mm. So that goes hand in hand, though, with what makes us such a wildly successful species, one of the things. And that is that, yes, we have this illusion of knowledge, but exists in part because, you know, as you write, we have communal knowledge that we've as organisms, we've been able to outboard expertise in so many different areas that it allows us as a species to accomplish a lot, right?
Exactly. So the idea is that we live in this illusion of knowledge because we confuse others' knowledge for our own. And the reason we have trouble distinguishing the source of knowledge is because we're all in it together. There's a division of cognitive labor, so we bring our own little bit of expertise to the table, and everyone else brings their own little bit of expertise, so that together there's a lot of expertise, there's a lot of knowledge. But the confusion has to do with what we know relative to what others know, and we sort of take credit for the community's knowledge.
Yeah, so there's a profoundly positive influence or impact of this communal knowledge. We've been talking about it in terms of, or I've been hearing you talk about it so far in terms of like communal knowledge and expertise, but there's also communal belief.
Yes.
And communal ignorance as well that all gets lumped in here.
Yeah. So I think it's important to distinguish issues like how toilets and ballpoint pens work from questions like what political policy we should pursue. So in the first case, there's general agreement about what is right, what ground truth is. So we can appeal to our community and we tend to agree about who the experts are, right? So in the case of a toilet, there are plumbers who are experts. But when it comes to political policy, it's not so clear. So the real problem we point to is what you might think of as contagious understanding, mm-hmm. right? We get a sense of understanding by virtue of the fact that the people around us have a sense of understanding. But if their sense of understanding depends on the sense of understanding of the people around them, then we could have a whole community that thinks it understands how things work, when in fact it's a house of cards, when in fact there's no real fundamental basis for that belief.
Yeah, I mean, so it provides a sort of social cohesion, but one that could be easily undermined if, again, as you said, it doesn't have any basis in fact. So, I mean, what are the implications for democracy then, if we're in a way sort of hardwired for this?
Yes. No, that's a good question. I do think it means that democracy is not perfectly consistent with the way minds are built, which, you know, is not necessarily a knock on democracy. I'm with Churchill that, you know, democracy is the worst system except for all the others. I don't think that the reason to live in a democratic society is because it's consistent with the way the mind works. But it does suggest, I think, that we should perhaps rely on expertise more than we sometimes do. Look, societies differ a lot in the extent to which they depend on expertise. One issue we take up in the book is what's often called direct democracy. So in, for instance, California, they have referenda all the time in which they allow individual citizens to vote on complex issues. And, you know, the world is just too complex for most people to understand, or at least for anybody to understand everything. And I really think it's a mistake to put really important decisions about complex matters in the hands of people who have other things to do with their time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but see, I guess part of my mind right now is stuck on this, the double-edged sword of the human brain, right? Because on the one hand, what you're saying is this basic hardwiring and also sort of social hardwiring that we have has allowed us to put a people on the moon, right? It's allowed
exactly.
us to invent the iPhone. It's allowed us to do all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it produces these pathways where we get these collective beliefs that are very, very, very hard to unwind from. So you've also done some experiments on how we can actually maybe gently start getting people to realize that they know less than they really do, and what effect that might have on these hardened sort of circles of collective belief that we have.
Right. Well, in some sense, I've already told you the procedure. So
yeah.
Kyle did this work on what he called the illusion of explanatory depth using everyday objects. We did it with political policies. So we asked people how well they understood, you know, various issues like cap and trade of carbon emissions, whether there should be unilateral sanctions on Iran, those kinds of things. And then we asked them to explain, and they found themselves unable to for the most part. And then again, we asked them to understand whether they understood the issue, and we found, like Kyle did, that we had punctured their illusion of understanding. But the other thing we did was ask them about their attitudes, how confident they felt about their attitudes towards the various policies. And we also punctured their confidence to some degree. So by virtue of explaining or trying and failing to explain how the policy worked, people became less confident, less extreme, less polarized.
So why do you think that is? I mean, what's the difference between having someone explain why they think, I don't know, clean water regulation works or doesn't versus having them defend their position?
Right. So, you know, we tend not to explain, or at least the vast majority of people tend not to engage in processes of explanation. What we do instead is we talk about our values. We talk about our community. We talk about what we think should be right and wrong, which is a discussion about how we relate to the policy. It's not actually a discussion about the policy itself. So what we propose is that if you can get the conversation to change to be one about how the policy will lead to consequences. That is a discussion that has nothing to do with you, right? That's about the policy itself on its own terms. Then you're going to find that people engage in a little more analysis. They're more open to compromise. And maybe we'll find some common ground to talk together if we talk in those terms.
And so how do you think that we might be able to practically inject this this sort of way of engaging with information and policy in real life. I mean, should people like me be asking different kind of questions when I have experts or politicians on?
It's your responsibility, Meghna. Absolutely.
We got to start somewhere.
Look, I do think that the answer is not in the place that most people jump to, which is simple education, right? So we're talking about a basic property of mind. We're talking about how people work at the most fundamental level. And I don't think you can simply educate people to operate and think in an entirely different way. I mean, I'm not arguing against the value of education in general, of course. I'm just saying that it's not going to be a silver bullet for this particular problem. So, yeah, we have to learn to reach outside our bubbles, right? We have to learn to talk to people in a respectful way. But more than anything, I think we have to try to separate the issues from our own interests.
Might be a tough call. Stephen Sloman's new book is called The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Zucchini skins from Kitchen Prep, a half burger left on a plate, food prepared for diners who didn't show. It all adds up to a whole lot of food waste for restaurants. Now, Nashville, Tennessee has been chosen by the Natural Resources Defense Council to be a model city on how to cut down on all that waste. A dozen chefs are taking part. Amy Eskine from Here and Now contributor WPLN reports.
Andrew Coins is the chef at Miel Restaurant, a high-end foodie favorite in West Nashville. Coins has been finding inventive ways to reduce, reuse, and recycle in his small, bustling kitchen.
It almost becomes a game, like how little do we have to compost? How much can we use in the restaurant itself? Because something you might have thrown away might end up being the amuse-bouche.
Amuse-bouche, that's a small bite of food the chef sends to the table to whet your appetite.
Yesterday, we had some carrot scraps, so I just took the juicer and juiced the carrot scrap and kind of made like a fresh carrot juice shot, if you will. So it was like fresh carrot juice, a little bit of Calabrian chili, and a little bit of fermented scallop. Scallops that had kind of been torn apart in the bucket. We couldn't use them for service.
Some of the ingredients for Coins' creations are actually rescued from cutting boards, diverted from compost bins at each prep station in the kitchen. The restaurant has also begun to compost used paper towels, and they're currently testing a menu of small plates meant to be shared to see if diners leave less food behind. Progress is tangible. The restaurant sent more than 6,000 pounds of food scraps off for composting last year. Perhaps it's not entirely clear why food doesn't just biodegrade in the landfill as easily as in a compost pile. Sharon Smith, Special Projects Manager at Nashville's Metro Public Works, explains that air and water are piped out of landfills, which slows degradation. So what happens to an apple core thrown in the trash?
It could last potentially for a couple of years.
And if it's tossed in a compost pile?
It'll be maybe a couple of weeks. It can be pretty quick.
But as part of the Nashville Food Waste Initiative, coordinator Linda Bregan wants even composting to be a last resort. She was hired to design a plan for the city and worked with the mayor's office to issue a challenge to the city's restaurants.
Ideally, the first thing we want them to do is prevent food waste from happening to begin with in terms of planning and purchasing practices, in terms of portion sizes, asking people at their restaurant whether they want bread with their meal. And then what we want them to do if they don't prevent food waste is to donate that food.
The federal government set a goal to cut food waste in half by 2030, a goal Nashville may formally adopt. To do that, it will take more than restaurant participation. The average family wastes $1,500 a year on food they don't eat, says Darby Hoover. She's with the Natural Resources Defense Council, a nonprofit that is spearheading a national effort to raise awareness and find solutions to food waste. All told, Hoover says 40% of food produced in the U.S. ends up in the trash.
That's equivalent to going in the grocery store, buying 5 bags of groceries, walking out and dropping 2 of them in the parking lot. That's how much food we're wasting. You're wasting energy, you're wasting water, you're wasting land and fertilizer. You're also wasting money.
The NRDC chose Nashville as a proving ground. They hope to achieve meaningful reductions that could convince other cities to give it a try. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Eskind.
There is renewed debate over an age-old question. Are we using escalators most efficiently by standing on the right and walking on the left? Would it be better for people to board 2x2 and all stand? Joining us now is Lee Gray, a professor of architectural history at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. And Lee, would it be fair to say that in addition to your title at UNC, you're also an escalator nerd?
Sure, why not?
Okay. And why? What fascinates you about them?
Well, my academic area of specialization is history of vertical transportation. So I spend a lot of time thinking about elevators, escalators, riding them when I can, looking at them, and observing how other people use them.
So one way that people use them, and this is well known across the world, is that you stand on one side, usually the right, and you walk up the left of the escalator. But in fact, there was a story recently that you should stand 2 abreast, so one person right next to the other. That's the most efficient way to use an escalator. Is that your view?
Well, the study was very interesting because it was conducted as in the London Underground, their subway system, and the aim was to reduce congestion as people exited trains. And while they proved that, I think reasonably conclusively, that when people did that, the congestion was less, but there's still the factor that it forced people who are accustomed to walking more quickly, perhaps on the left, to standing still. And there was some controversy about that.
Well, and why would anybody do that? It seems like it would be not efficient for you as an individual escalator user. It would only be good for everyone.
Well, that's exactly the point. You know, it's one of these sort of greater good, perhaps, versus the individual.
What do you do when you get on an escalator?
I always stand on the right because I like to people watch, and I also like to look at the installation to get an idea of, you know, the escalator I'm riding on. Sometimes they're really boring and sometimes they're very interesting.
So you obviously pay a lot of attention to escalators, and your fascination led you to dig into their history. What did you learn about how escalators came about?
Well, escalators were originally developed for how many of us use them now. They were developed for mass transit systems originally in New York to get passengers up to the elevated train station. And then they very quickly were adopted in subway systems that were developed in the early part of the 20th century. And a secondary use, but also proved to be very popular, was in department stores, which were emerging 1890s, early 20th century. And there they both helped move customers more easily from floor to floor. But they also had a secondary use in department stores in that you now had standing passengers who would look around, and they would often position merchandise strategically so that shoppers could observe it.
While you're riding on the escalator.
Right.
Are escalators different today than they were then? It seems like as long as I've been alive, they've been about the same.
Very, very few changes that the average person would see. The makeup of the stairs you stand on has changed. There are now new types of plastic that are being used in some settings. The machinery is sort of fine-tuned. They're much, much safer, for instance, than they were 100 years ago. But for all intents and purposes, the basic technology has not changed for over 100 years.
And we don't see that many escalators outside, but there are some famous cases of escalators that are outside. In Hong Kong, there are escalators outdoors, but they do have a little roof over the top of them. And in Las Vegas, and I know you've been on them in Las Vegas, there are some outdoor escalators. Can they survive in the rain like that, or do they have to be shut down when that happens?
For escalators that are designed to be outside, certainly they take a lot more wear and tear, and I'm certain require a lot more maintenance than an escalator inside. That's probably the biggest difference, is maintaining them is much more intensive.
How dangerous are escalators? I always think, you know, if you drop something on an escalator, don't reach down and pick it up because your finger could get caught in there. But what about the dangers?
Well, by and large, escalators are very, very safe. They are, if we think vertical transportation, they are more dangerous than an elevator only in that there are more moving parts. And it's this sort of massive machine that, while it is made as precisely as it possibly can be to eliminate accidents, yes, you can, if you were careless or not careful, get a finger caught or something like that. So, I mean, that's why, and it goes back to the walking issue. You know, the best recommendation is stand, hold the railing, ride the escalator, get on and off very carefully, and, you know, 99.9% of the time, you'd be fine.
And get on and off very carefully is important because the speed of an escalator is actually very carefully calculated because people will be too scared to get on it if it's going too quickly.
Right. The average speed of an escalator is about 1 to 2 feet per second, 90 to 120 feet per minute, which in theory is average walking speed. So the average person, if they step on at their normal walking pace, should not have any trouble exiting or entering. And what I think is interesting about it is this has always been a part of the American psyche. We like to go fast. The pace of business is fast. And while the escalator is convenient, anything to get me there faster is a good thing.
Hmm. So you've been on some pretty crazy escalators, including a curved one. What did you find there?
Well, the only curving escalators I've had the pleasure of riding were in Las Vegas at the shops at Caesars. And those were fun simply because they go around about a three-quarter curve. And it's a very different experience. And those are – the curving escalators are only about 20 to 25 years old. And it took almost 80 years to develop them because if you think about the technology of a straight escalator, that's difficult enough. But when it's going around a curve and the steps have to go up and down and return, it becomes very complicated. They're almost like an amusement ride kind of feeling. And in fact, the very first escalator, what we would think of today as a proof of concept model, was installed at Coney Island in New York as an amusement ride.
Hmm. But most people don't view them that way anymore.
No, no. It's this utilitarian device that means I don't have to climb the stairs.
Right, exactly. And there is one that you were on, I know, in Macy's in New York that has its original wooden steps.
Yes. Originally, all escalators had wooden steps. And as far as I know, there's only one left in the United States, and it's in Macy's in New York City. And it's the very top escalator in the building, and it still has its original wooden balustrades on either side. And for, as you said earlier, escalator nerds like me, one of the joys of this escalator is the sound it makes as it operates because of the wooden steps. It has this sort of wonderful mechanical sound to it that is unique and really quite wonderful.
How long is too long for an escalator, do you think?
Well, there are some very long escalators. The longest escalator in the United States is in one of the D.C. metro stations.
Right. It's the Wheaton, Maryland stop, I think. That
exactly
goes very
right. It's
long.
230 feet long, and it has a vertical rise of about 115 feet. So, you know, if we think about the normal speed, that's about a that's almost a three-minute ride if you're standing still.
Right. Do you think that's too long?
Well,
for one escalator? Because you could also break it up and have you go down one and then have a platform and then go down another.
That's a really good question. I don't know. I mean, given the depth of the subway station, the choice really is to either have very, very, very large elevators that can carry 100, 125 people to get people in and out of the station or to use an escalator. The escalator's probably cheaper. And the advantage is for passengers, if we think escalators over elevators, the escalator's always there and it's always running.
Well, it's always running until it doesn't work one day and then you got to walk up that entire distance.
Well, that's true. That's very true. And when that happens, it's not a happy thing.
That's Lee Gray, a professor of architectural history at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, talking with us about escalators. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Down there, escalator.
And by the way, one of the worst things you can do on an escalator is drop a bag of screws into it. They are very hard to find and take out. You're listening to Here and Now.
The person who police say murdered an elderly man in Cleveland and posted a video of it on Facebook is now dead. Officials say Steve Stevens killed himself after he was spotted and pursued in Pennsylvania. And the video of that Cleveland murder sparked an outrage over how Facebook monitors offensive and violent content. And this just comes as the company opens its annual developers conference called F8 today in San Jose. It's an event usually meant to highlight Facebook's latest technology and initiatives. For a view from F8, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode, with Kurt Wagner, senior editor of social media for Recode. He joins us from the conference via Skype. Hi there, Kurt.
Hi.
Well, first of all, I mean, let's talk more specifically about Facebook's response to the Cleveland story and that video. I mean, are there standards in place to remove disturbing, violent videos like this? And if so, why did it take a couple hours for Facebook to bring it down?
There are standards in place. Facebook has a, you know, set of community guidelines that it tries to use to govern its entire social network for all the different countries of the world. And obviously, this video certainly violated those guidelines. The reason it took so long, though, is that Facebook isn't proactive in terms of going out and seeking this kind of violent or aggressive or inappropriate content. It waits for users to actually report it, and then it has to go through the process of verifying that it needs to be taken down and then actually taking it down. So in a blog post that they published yesterday, they basically outlined the timeline, and it took about 2 hours, which I think a lot of people would agree is probably too slow.
Okay, interesting. So it's relying on users to flag these videos. I mean, but this is not the first instance of this kind of content being on Facebook. Just to list some recent ones, last summer, the death of Philando Castile, who was fatally shot by police in Minnesota, that was live streamed on Facebook. In January, three Swedish men were arrested on suspicion of raping a woman and streaming the video of it. And in February, two radio journalists in the Dominican Republic were fatally shot again, broadcast live. I mean, so how has Facebook responded to what seems to be a growing number of these kinds of videos on its platform?
So, yeah, I feel personally that it's a problem, and that a lot of people will say that this is a very small amount of the overall live stream content that you can find on Facebook, which is very true. But it's very clear also that the live stream capability is not being monitored the way that it needs to. And I think the ultimate goal here for Facebook is to create some kind of technology that can detect what's happening in a video as it's happening, and so that it would be able to monitor these videos literally while they are live streamed. The problem is they don't have that technology yet. And so the response thus far has simply been, you know, we're devastated or horrified by what we're seeing. We've taken it down and we're going to try and move faster next time. And we've now heard that over and over again. And I think that, you know, it creates a conversation around, is this live product the kind of product that Facebook needs to be offering right now?
Right. So I want to get back to that in a second. But when you said that, you know, maybe Facebook should be aggressively pursuing technology that allows them to police these streams, is there any pushback to that notion? Because, I mean, are there groups of people who wouldn't want Facebook to do this?
I think there's always going to be groups of people who are a fan of the free internet. All things go, no content is taken down. I think companies have different levels of, you know, comfort with that idea. I think Twitter, for example, has been a pretty free speech platform over the years, has allowed a lot of things to stay up on the site that people would like to see taken down, either bullying or, you know, harassment. And I think as a result, Twitter's gotten a label as being a place where if you want to engage in that activity, you go to Twitter to do that. I don't think Facebook wants to be that place, and they've tried to avoid that by, you know, requiring people to sign up with their real identity. You can't be anonymous on Facebook. And so, yes, I'm sure there will be people who say, well, we don't want Facebook censoring anything that goes up on its site. But ultimately, that's, you know, that's a small percentage, in my opinion. And I think the vast majority of people want to be safer.
Right. And I mean, there's also the issue of, while this may be a small percentage of the video content that gets posted to Facebook, I mean, the power of Facebook is that it has a couple billion users. So that video can spread quite quickly. I mean, it has a long reach. I mean, is there any conversation that you've heard of about at Facebook of people being concerned that maybe some of these violent actions are driven or even inspired by the prospect of the fact that quickly millions of eyes could see them.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a belief by some, is that is there a psychological kind of impact here of saying I can go to Facebook, and because of the fact that the company can't detect that this video might be violent right away, if enough people start watching it, that automatically triggers it to be shown to more people, right? And so by the time the company finally realizes, oh, this isn't a video that we want out there, it may be too late. So Facebook has this virality that I think you don't get with YouTube or with just a regular website on the internet. There's a way for stuff to go kind of exponentially larger than it would otherwise. And I think that, you know, for people who want the attention, who want to stir things up, Facebook is a good opportunity to get the reach that they wouldn't get in other parts of the web.
Well, Kurt Wagner is senior editor of social media for Recode. Kurt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.